The new record will be released in a few weeks' time. Basically, what's your current feelings regarding this new chapter?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting way to put it. Chapters are a great analogy for what a band does when it releases a record. You know, it's a moment in time. It'll be a couple of years of touring on this. It will be a document of this period in history that we're in. And my feeling is one of hope and one of optimism. And I think that when I've said that to people in my interviews today, it's kind of shocked them a bit, because the world seems so tumultuous and so filled with pain right now that to have optimism in the face of that seems maybe naive. But truthfully, I think that people like Donald Trump galvanize the world and make people really make a choice between being apathetic and being empathetic. And the more people we have choosing empathy in this world, the more chance we have of diverting ourselves from a path of neo-fascism, of continued racism, of sexism, homophobia, transphobia, all the bigotry that you see dominating the rhetoric of Donald Trump and world leaders like the AfD in Germany, Boris Johnson in the UK, neoliberal globalist politicians like Macron here in France. The more chance we have to derail the train from this path to endless fascism in the face of people who are hurting. So I think that that this record is a chapter of the band is us trying to make a statement about 2020, about writing our own future as we enter a new decade.
Okay, makes sense. If we come back a little to the American Fall period, is there, I don't know, a souvenir or something that in your mind would kind of sum up the whole period from writing, recording, touring after that for this album?
Yeah, that's another very cool question as well. I think that for me it was introducing American Attraction, which is the first song of the album. It's been the most popular song from that record. That was a fearful moment for us. We felt like we kind of diverted from the songwriting formula of Anti-Flag to come up with this song that was really repetitive in its musicality, but really focused on the politics that led us to a Donald Trump presidency.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a scary, risky moment for the band. The fact that it's become the quintessential song from that era really kind of enforces to us the belief that we need to follow our instincts and do what's true to us as a band, because that's what tends to be the most attractive to people who interact with the band, is when we're truest to ourselves.
Okay. I have the idea, it might be a cliche, that at the end of each new chapter or period, you kind of, or you guys gather together and decide what you want to do next. If it's the case, what was the main driver for this new record, for this 2020 vision?
Well, that's 100% what happens. The main driver of the record was a simple conversation about making sure that as we enter a new decade, we're on the record commenting on Donald Trump, Mike Pence, and the path that we're on. So I don't know if it's because I am a product of the Star Wars era or the sci-fi era, but the year 2020 feels big to me. It feels bigger than most most moments we've had as a band. So I wanted to make sure that we had a record out in January. It's not a specifically good time in the record industry to release an album. A lot of people are traveling or not working for the holidays, and it leads to a lot of stress. But for us, it was more about the artistic statement of releasing a record. And you know, title track in particular, the song 2020 Vision, which is about us taking a collective headcount of people who care about more than just themselves, people who want to see the world look differently in the next decade moving forward. So, yeah, I mean, you're right that we do get together and formulate plans, because we learned very early on in the band's life that we are our best when we're setting goals and we're setting attainable goals. You know, we're friends with Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, and he told us about when Rage started their band, they had a list of goals as wide arrayed as painting the White House black to signing a record deal. So, like, I think that you can think about how big you want things to be internally, what the statements you want to make are. You know, and 2020 Vision as an album is different for us in a lot of ways, and I think the most important way is that it's the only record where we've kind of attacked a president or a politician with the artwork. So Donald Trump on the cover. Furthermore, we had the color art made before the record was recorded. We had the title track and the name of the record before we recorded the record. That shit never happens in our world. Usually that's the end of it. We're mostly focused on the songs and the political statements. This time we were a little more prepared with what that statement was going to be going into making the album.
Okay. Do you remember how many songs you write or prepare for this record, and what share did you keep from that all writing sessions?
Yeah, we wrote a fucking ton. I personally wrote over 35 songs for the record.
Mm-hmm.
Justin brought in like another 10. We wrote a handful of songs together in the room rehearsing. So we had somewhere over 50 songs for the album, and that's simply because when you've been a band as long as we have, this is our 12th album, it doesn't make sense to make one unless it fills a purpose or fills a void that wasn't there. If it's not as good or better than previous things that we've created, why risk damaging what we've worked 25 years to build? So that's where a lot of that work ethic and the songwriting comes from.
And yes, please.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, a lot of those songs, sometimes they get cannibalized. We take lyrics from them and put them on other songs. So they all kind of get used either as a direction that we don't want to go in, or maybe it's something we hold for the future. But yeah, I mean, we definitely tried to be more thoughtful in the songs that actually made the record.
All right. One thing we can say about your music, it's like it's really direct, you know, punch in the guts. Do you kind of work with this idea in mind? Do you kind of make, like, you find a riff or you find a melody, and if it's not energetic or powerful enough, you kind of put it on the side and work on something else?
Yeah, that's a part of it. I mean, there's no real formula to how we write an anti-flag record or an anti-flag song. I mean, we're open to all of the ways and all of the ideas. I think that the one thing we are purposefully trying to do is write the catchiest song, a song that stays with people beyond the first listen, because we think the message of the song is very important, and the more ingrained that melody is in your head, the more likely you are to do the work to find out what the song is about or why why you find yourself humming it walking down the street. So I think that that's always a part of our agenda, is be better songwriters so that people carry these messages with them into their daily lives.
Okay. In general, what you could you tell us about the recording session for 2020 Vision, and especially the your work with Matt Good?
Yeah, so Matt is a great friend of ours. We made the record in Los Angeles at the MDDN Studios, which were managed by Benji and Joel of Good Charlotte, and they have their office, which is also a studio, and that's where we made American Fall, and that's where we made 2020 Vision, and ultimately, it's the fastest record we've ever made. We made it in under 3 weeks, which for Anti-Flag, that's really fast. And I think that that's, you know, partly because how prepared we were. We really went through the songs and had it narrowed down to 14 that we actually recorded with Matt. Of those, we finished 13 in those 3 weeks. And then from there, we cut it down to the 11 that appear on the record. And Matt was also a great facilitator in the sense that he understood what the songs needed. He brought a lot of really interesting things to the band, and he actually had some ideas that we had never had before. He was really adamant about making sure the vocals were clear and that the lyrics were enunciated, and he would talk about how the songs are so message based, we need to make sure that the message comes across. And you know, that's something that we had never really thought about. We thought as long as the chorus was catchy or the melody was catchy, people would do the work to investigate further. But he made sure that we were you know, singing properly and saying things in a way that made sense to people. And I think that's one of the new additions to this record that Matt brought and helped our band learn.
Okay. After, as you mentioned, 12 records and like 30 years of experience, one way or the other, do you think that in the future you might decide to go without a producer to work only by yourself, maybe with the sound engineers, but not with someone as a producer?
Yeah, that, you know, it's interesting because we have done it all. You know, we've made records in closets for no money. We were signed to a major label, and we made records that cost a lot of money to make with big name producers. And then right after the major label, we built a studio in Pittsburgh, and we recorded 2 records there by ourselves. And, you know, then the newest kind of thing we've done is do a lot of the pre-production at home in our studio, meet with a producer who can help us make the record sound modern, and that's what we did with Benji on American Fall and now Matt Good on 2020 Vision. And, you know, I like going back to just kind of talking about what the album means and why it's coming out in January 2020. And, you know, we wanted to make a record that sounds like now. We didn't think it would be true to the songs and to the statements to make a record that sounds like a 1977 punk rock record. You know, we needed to make something that sounded modern. And so part of why we are so open to working with other people is that they always bring something to the table sonically. So Matt was, like I said, a great facilitator at getting those sounds, at keeping the record modern, at keeping the ideas at the forefront of the messaging of the music. But yeah, I mean, you know, we love recording and making records. It's something we're always going to do. So the odds of us making records ourselves in our own studio are very high, the same way the odds of us working with different people and collaborating on different things are very high. I think that the beauty of us is that we feel that ideas are for everyone, and so we want to share in the creative process with as many people as possible. I think that we kind of get stuck in this rut that, like, to be a true artist, you need to create yourself, and that collaboration is bad. But I believe we're making music that is for the collective, so therefore we want to make it as a collective.
All right. At some point during the writing process, you kind of establish a short list of producers you would like to work with, or how do you decide who to work with?
Yeah, that was interesting, because we, for this record, we just worried about the songs and had a plan to essentially make the album the same way we made American Fall. And that was the idea, that we were just going to go to MDN with an engineer, and Benji would pop his head in and out and kind of co-produce with us the way he did American Fall. And he actually brought up Matt, and he had worked with him on some other projects, and he said, look, you know, I think that this guy might have some great ideas for you. And so we just kind of trusted that idea. And we've known Matt for a long time. He was in the band from first to last, and we did Warped Tour together several times in the early mid-2000s. And we just kind of picked right up where we left off as friends and as kindred spirits who have been through a lot of the same experiences. There was really no list. Matt was the only list we had.
Okay. Coming back to a little about the American politics, it seems from France that the American system was pretty much a game of balances between different powers, executive powers, the Senate, and so on, the House of Representatives, and Trump seems to kind of went through this whole system, and all the inquiry process progress seemed to Trump really unbalance the system. Do you think one way or the other the system is strong enough to come back to its feet and remove the how could I say the evil agent?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, truthfully, I don't know. The work is up to us to be in the streets of the United States demanding accountability to politicians who do not do the work to fix the system and correct that failure that you're talking about. So I think that it's quite possible that those in economic power in America, that economic power then parallels to political power in America. Those people are so desperate for the status quo and a Joe Biden election or a Ted Cruz election that they'll continue to allow executive order. They'll continue to allow for corporate interest to be the rule of the day in favor of status quo. So I that part of our future is certainly unwritten. I do think, however, that Donald Trump being able to pose as a populist while he continues to super serve the elite, that is in balance. And you see a lot of what we're seeing from a lot of Donald Trump supporters in America is the distaste for him consistently passing over those that are in need. That's starting to come around. And, I mean, there's a lot of people who voted for him who will never admit their failure or admit their wrongdoing and so. And, you know, that's part of human nature where people just don't want to admit that they're wrong. But I certainly believe that there's a great chance that we can correct where we're at. It's just how much of a correction happens. Does the correction happen to, you know, the status quo of a Joe Biden, or does the correction happen to a new morality imposed where someone like Bernie Sanders has the option to give us a healthcare and an education system that benefits people versus benefiting corporations?
So basically, in the potential candidate on both sides, especially Democrats, Yeah, so you just mentioned it. I suppose Bernie Sanders or maybe Elizabeth Warren could be someone you could, one way or the other, or maybe the lesser of all evil, or could do something better for the American people?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly believe that any Democratic candidate is who the most... is the most likely to get my vote. I mean, I'm not a fan of Joe Biden. I have a lot of anxiety about Elizabeth Warren and her inability to not commit to staying away from corporate money when she runs in a general election.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone like Kamala Harris is someone who I believe, as a former prosecutor, has done a lot of things to perpetrate and further the unjust political justice system we have in America.
But I don't know if you just saw the news, but Kamala Harris just announced she's dropping out of the race.
Oh, she's dropping out. Okay, well, there you go. That's one less.
So everybody's saying in the American media that, you know, she might be now in going more to the vice president position. I just mentioned it because it was like it happened in the news that she decided to go to drop the race.
Oh, I didn't know that. I appreciate you filling me in. Now, yeah, I mean, to be honest, it would be fantastic if one way or another it was a Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren ticket.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would really rally both sides of people who are hungry for politics that is empathetic.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, it's all going to come down to, again, how much tearing apart happens. You know, whether it's from Donald Trump tearing apart any Republican who comes after Donald Trump, or Donald Trump tearing apart any Democrat who comes. The machine behind him is insanely powerful. You know, Bernie Sanders broke a campaign contribution record for a Democratic candidate, raising $25 million in a month, all of it non-corporate money.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump, in that same month, with corporate money, raised $125
million. Yes, so unbalanced.
The deck is certainly stacked against those that are trying to operate outside of corporate-funded politics.
All right. To come back a little bit in the artistic world, you shot a video clip for 8 Conquers All before you released a lyrics video for Christian Nationalist.
Yeah.
To come back to 8 Conquers All, you basically did a video that you playing on top of a building. Is that in Pittsburgh?
No, it was in Los Angeles.
Okay, and so in general, how did you go, and do you like the exercise of shooting video clips? Is that a necessary pain, or it's kind of fun?
Necessary pain.
Okay.
Slightly fun, you know.
Just for that kind of clip, how many times do you think you had to play and replay the song?
Well, that was an interesting one, because it was shot half...
Night? Half day?
Yeah. So we had this thing where it was like, okay, hurry up, do it now. So we did it like 6 times in a row. And then it was like, okay, wait. And then hurry up and do it now, because it's getting too dark. So, I mean, that was an interesting video to shoot, just in the sense that we split it up there by time. But, yeah, I don't like faking anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do a music video, for the most part, you're not really playing. So that part of it has always felt weird to me, and like a necessary pain, like you said. But it is cool, and it is, you know, it's a thing that we get to do that is an extension of the music that is outside of our realm. And a lot of times, because we're not video directors, that goes back into the collaboration side of things, where we get to work with different artists that we wouldn't normally work with, or talk with people and get their interpretation of song that we wouldn't normally have otherwise. So that video idea was kind of like kicked around by the four of us. We came up with it, but the execution of it was certainly out of our hands. So we had no idea what it was going to look like until we got the final video, and then we were really happy with what Jake had done.
Okay. Do you have other video clips in production?
Yeah, we do. I'm sorry. I'm trying to. Okay. I think I got it. Someone was calling on the other line of his phone, so I couldn't figure out how to hang up on them.
No problem. Technical issues.
Yeah. So we have a video that drops this Friday for a song called Unbreakable.
All right.
That song in particular was an interesting and maybe as far as acts of the record is maybe the most outsider, because it was really born out of this tremendously personal space for Justin. He wrote that song after his mother had passed, and it definitely was coming from his headspace that he was in, the family's headspace. I mean, she was a tremendous pillar in the structure of the family. And, Justin's the youngest of nine kids, so
very emotional.
It was very emotional. So, but when it came into me, and I had heard it, and when Pat had heard it, and Ed had heard it, it really spoke to the political movements that we're seeing happening right now around the world, where people are standing up to oppression and banding together in the face of seemingly unprecedented times. So we wanted to kind of keep that personal aspect of it, but also extrapolate into what the rest of us were hearing with the messaging of the song. And then I was on Twitter and saw this video about this group of filmmakers in Nigeria, and they were using broken cell phones and blankets as green screens and a computer that kept crashing, and they could only make videos that were less than 5 minutes long because the computer didn't have the capacity to render bigger files.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was really inspired by their story, so I sent them that song, and they made this really amazing video talking about how they're filmmakers, and that comes out on Friday. Actually, the video drops on Thursday. The song is released worldwide on Friday. And
all right.
And then the follow-up to that will be closer to the album's release. We have a video for a song called The Disease, that one's pretty cool, too. So, while I don't love making music videos, I always am excited about the possibility of extrapolating on the art in a new way.
Okay. Just a final question, because it's about time. A little more personal. Basically, in your past, what was the spark that lightened your will, need, crave to become an artist?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, when I, as I've been kind of doing this look back over the band, especially as we hit 25 years, and this is record 12, 2020. It all feels big. I don't think there was one thing that happened, aside from seeing Green Day and recognizing that it was within my power to create. I think that they really humanized artists for me, because they looked like me. They weren't perfect. They weren't pretty. They were themselves, and that made me believe that I didn't need to be someone else to create. But I can go back through my life and recognize the moments when I was politicized, and recognize the moments where my family felt pain and struggle, where, police were fucking with my brother, and it connected me with NWA and fuck the police. And then when I being a product of single mother and seeing the infrastructure of Pittsburgh shipped overseas in lieu of cheap labor and becoming politicized and finding the dead Kennedys. You know, all of those kind of arcs and moments whenever I came in contact with art that was angry and a message that was saying something, all of that kind of culminated with, you know, finding Green Day, finding punk rock, and recognizing an outlet for those feelings that I was having.
All right. Once again, thank you very much for taking the time to answer our questions, and our best wishes for the months to come.
Great. I greatly appreciate it. Thank you, and have a great night, brother.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.